Umly. He shook their hands weakly.
You the conductor? Caesar asked.
No good with steam, Lumley said. More of a station agent.
When not concerning himself with railroad matters, he said, he led a quiet life on his farm. This was his land. Cora and Caesar needed to arrive under the blanket or else blindfolded, he explained. Best they remain ignorant of their location.
I was expecting 3 passengers today, he said. You'll be able to stretch out.
Before they could figure his words, Fletcher informed them it was time for him to return to his wife.
My part is finished, my friends.
He embraced the runaways with desperate affection. Cora couldn't help but shrink away. 2 white men in 2 days had their hands around her. Was this a condition of her freedom? Caesar silently watched the shopkeeper and his cart depart. Fletcher addressed his horses, and then his voice trailed away. Concern troubled the features of Cora's companion. Fletcher had undertaken a great risk for them, even when the situation grew more complicated than he had bargained. The only currency to satisfy the debt was their survival and to help others when circumstances permitted. By her accounting, at least. Caesar owed the man much more for taking him into his shop all those months before. That is what she saw in his face. Not concern, but responsibility. Lumley shut the barn door, the chains jingling with the vibration. Lumley was not as sentimental. He lit a lantern and gave it to Caesar while he kicked some hay and pulled up a trap door in the floor. At their trepidation, he said,
I'll go first, if you wish.
The stairwell was lined with stones and a sour smell emanated from below. It did not open into a cellar, but continued down. Cora appreciated the labor that had gone into its construction. The steps were steep, but the stones aligned in even planes and provided an easy descent. Then they reached the tunnel. And appreciation became too mealy a word to contain what lay before her. The stairs led onto a small platform. The black mouths of the gigantic tunnel opened at either end. It must have been 20 feet tall, walls lined with dark and light-colored stones in an alternating pattern. The sheer industry that had made such a project possible. Cora and Caesar noticed the rails. 2 steel rails ran the visible length of the tunnel, pinned into the dirt by wooden cross ties. The steel ran south and north, presumably, springing from some inconceivable source and shooting toward a miraculous terminus. Someone had been thoughtful enough to arrange a small bench on the platform. Cora felt dizzy and sat down. Caesar could scarcely speak.
How far does the tunnel extend?
Lumley shrugged.
Far enough for you.
It must have taken years.
More than you know. Solving the problem of ventilation, that took a bit of time.
Who built it?
Who builds anything in this country?
Cora saw that Lumley relished their astonishment. This was not his first performance. Caesar said,
But how?
With their hands. How else?
We need to discuss your departure.
Lumley pulled a yellow paper from his pocket and squinted.
You have 2 choices. We have a train leaving in 1 hour. And another in 6 hours. Not the most convenient schedule. Would that our passengers could time their arrivals more appropriately, but we operate under certain constraints.
The next one, Cora said, standing. There was no question.
The trick of it is, They're not going to the same place, Lumley said. One's going one way, and the other...
To where? Cora asked.
Away from here. That's all I can tell you. You understand the difficulties in communicating all the changes in the routes, locals, expresses, what stations close down, where they're extending the heading. The problem is that one destination may be more to your liking than another. Stations are discovered, lines discontinued. You won't know what waits above until you pull in.
The runaways didn't understand. From the station agent's words, one route might be more direct but more dangerous. Was he saying one route was longer? Lumley would not elaborate. He had told them all he knew, he maintained. In the end, the slaves' choice lay before them, as ever. Any place but where they had escaped. After consulting with his partner, Caesar said, "We'll take the next one."
"It's up to you," Lumley said.
He motioned toward the bench. They waited. At Caesar's request, the station agent told of how he came to work for the Underground Railroad. Cora couldn't pay attention. The tunnel pulled at her. How many hands had it required to make this place? And the tunnels beyond, wherever and how far they led. She thought of the picking, how it raced down the furrows at harvest, the African bodies working as one, as fast as their strength permitted, the vast fields burst with hundreds of thousands of white bowls, strung like stars in the sky on the clearest of clear nights. When the slaves finished, they had stripped the fields of their color. It was a magnificent operation from seed to bale, but not one of them could be prideful of their labor. It had been stolen from them, bled from them. The tunnel, the tracks, the desperate souls who found salvation in the coordination of its stations and timetables. This was a marvel to be proud of. She wondered if those who had built this thing had received their proper reward.
"Every state is different," Lumley was saying. "Each one a state of possibility, with its own customs and way of doing things. Moving through them, you'll see the breadth of the country before you reach your final stop."
At that, the bench rumbled. They hushed, and the rumbling became a sound. Lumley led them to the edge of the platform. The thing arrived in its hulking strangeness. Caesar had seen trains in Virginia. Cora had only heard tell of the machines. It wasn't what she envisioned. The locomotive was black, an ungainly contraption led by the triangular snout of the cow catcher, though there would be few animals where this engine was headed. The bulb of the smokestack was next, a soot-covered stalk. The main body consisted of a large black box topped by the engineer's cabin. Below that, pistons and large cylinders engaged in a relentless dance with the 10 wheels, two sets of small ones in front and three behind. The locomotive pulled one single car, a dilapidated boxcar, missing numerous planks in its walls. The colored engineer waved back at them from his cabin, grinning toothlessly.
"All aboard," he said.
To curtail Caesar's annoying interrogations, Lumley quickly unhooked the boxcar door and slid it wide.
"Shall we proceed?"
Cora and Caesar climbed into the car, and Lumley abruptly shut them in. He peered between the gaps in the wood.
"If you want to see what this nation is all about, I always say you have to ride the rails. Look outside as you speed through and you'll find the true face of America."
He slapped the wall of the boxcar as a signal. The train lurched forward. The runaways lost their balance and stumbled to the nest of hay bales that was to serve as seating. The boxcar creaked and shuddered. It was no new model, and on numerous occasions during their trip, Cora feared it was on the verge of collapse. The car was empty apart from hay bales, dead mice, and bent nails. She later discovered a charred patch where someone had started a fire. Caesar was numb from the series of curious events, and he curled up on the floor. Following Lumley's final instructions, Cora looked through the slats. There was only darkness, mile after mile. When they next stepped into the sunlight, they were in South Carolina. She looked up at the skyscraper and reeled, wondering how far she had traveled. Ridgway. Arnold Ridgway's father was a blacksmith. The sunset glow of molten iron bewitched him, the way the color emerged in the stock slow and then fast, overtaking it like an emotion. The sudden pliability and restless writhing of the thing as it waited for purpose. His forge was a window into the primitive energies of the world. He had a saloon partner named Tom Bird, a half-breed, who took a sentimental turn when lubricated by whiskey. On nights when Tom Bird felt separate from his life's design, he shared stories of the Great Spirit. The Great Spirit lived in all things, the earth, the sky, the animals and forests, flowing through and connecting them in a divine thread. Although Ridgway's father scorned religious talk, Tom Bird's testimony on the Great Spirit reminded him of how he felt about iron. He bent to no god save the glowing iron he tended in his forge. He'd read about the great volcanoes, the lost city of Pompeii, destroyed by fire that poured out of mountains from deep below. Liquid fire was the very blood of the earth. It was his mission to upset, mash, and draw out the metal into the useful things that made society operate. Nails, horseshoes, plows, knives, guns, chains. Working the spirit, he called it. When permitted, young Ridgway stood in the corner while his father worked Pennsylvania iron, melting, hammering, dancing around his anvil, sweat dripping down his face, covered in soot foot to crown, blacker than an African devil. You gotta work that spirit, boy. One day he would find his spirit, his father told him. It was encouragement. Ridgway hoisted it as a lonesome burden. There was no model for the type of man he wanted to become. He couldn't turn to the anvil because there was no way to surpass his father's talent. In town, he scrutinized the faces of men in the same way that his father searched for impurities in metal. Everywhere, men busied themselves in frivolous and worthless occupations. The farmer waited on rain like an imbecile. The shopkeeper arranged row after row of necessary but dull merchandise. Craftsmen and artisans created items that were brittle rumors compared with his father's iron facts. Even the wealthiest men, influencing the far-off London exchanges and local commerce alike, provided no inspiration. He acknowledged their place in the system, erecting their big houses on a foundation of numbers, but he didn't respect them. If you weren't a little dirty at the end of the day, you weren't much of a man. Every morning, the sounds of his father pounding metal were the footsteps of a destiny that never drew closer. Ridgway was 14 when he took up with the patrollers. He was a hulking 14, 6.5 feet tall, burly and resolute. His body gave no indication of the confusion within. He beat his fellows when he spied his weaknesses in them. Ridgway was young for patrol, but the business was changing. King Cotton crowded the countryside with slaves. The revolts in the West Indies and disquieting incidents closer to home worried the local planters. What clear-thinking white man wouldn't be worried, slaver or otherwise? The patrols increased in size, as did their mandate. A boy might find a place. The head patroller in the county was the fiercest specimen Ridgway had ever laid eyes on. Chandler was a brawler and bully, the local terror decent people crossed the street to avoid, even when the rain made it a stew of mud. He spent more days in jail than the runaways he brought in, snoring in a cell next to the miscreant he had stopped hours earlier. An imperfect model, but close to the shape Ridgway sought. Inside the rules, enforcing them, but also outside. It helped that his father hated Chandler, still smarting from a row years before. Ridgway loved his father, but the man's constant talk of spirits reminded him of his own lack of purpose. Patrol was not difficult work. They stopped any niggers they saw and demanded their passes. They stopped niggers they knew to be free for their amusement, but also to remind the Africans of the forces arrayed against them, whether they were owned by a white man or not. Made the rounds of the slave villages in search of anything amiss, a smile, or a book. They flogged the wayward niggers before bringing them to the jail or directly to their owner if they were in the mood, and it was not too close to quitting time. News of a runaway sent them into cheerful activity. They raided the plantations after their quarry, interrogating a host of quivering darkies. Free men knew what was coming and hid their valuables and moaned when the white men smashed their furniture and glass, praying that they confined their damage to objects. There were perquisites. Apart from the thrill of shaming a man in front of his family or roughing up an unseasoned buck who squinted at you the wrong way, the old Mutter farm had the comeliest colored wenches. Mr. Mutter had a taste, and the excitement of the hunt put a young patroller in a lusty mood. According to some, the backwoods stills of the old men on the Stone Plantation produced the best corn whiskey in the county. A roust allowed Chandler to replenish his jars. Ridgway commanded his appetites in those days, withdrawing before his Confederates' more egregious displays. The other patrollers were boys and men of bad character. The work attracted a type. In another country, they would have been criminals, but this was America. He liked the night work best, when they lay in wait for a buck who sneaked through the woods to visit his wife on a plantation up the road, or a squirrel hunter looking to supplement his daily meal of slop. Other patrollers carried guns and eagerly cut down any rascal dumb enough to flee, but Ridgway copied Chandler. Nature had equipped him with weapons enough. Ridgway ran them down as if they were rabbits, and then his fists subdued them. Beat them for being out, beat them for running, even though the chase was the only remedy for his restlessness. Charging through the dark, branches lashing his face, stumps sending him ass over elbow before he got up again, in the chase, his blood sang and glowed. When his father finished his workday, the fruit of his labor lay before him, a musket, a rake, a wagon spring. Ridgway faced the man or woman he had captured. One made tools, the other retrieved them. His father teased him about the spirit. What kind of a calling was running down niggers who barely have the wits of a dog? Ridgway was 18 now, a man.
"We're both of us working for Mr. Eli Whitney," he said.
It was true. His father had just hired two apprentices and contracted work out to smaller smiths. The cotton gin meant bigger cotton yields, and the iron tools to harvest it, iron horseshoes for the horses, tugging the wagons with iron rims, and parts that took it to market. More slaves and the iron to hold them, The crop birthed communities requiring nails and braces for houses, the tools to build the houses, roads to connect them, and more iron to keep it all running. Let his father keep his disdain and his spirit, too. The two men were parts of the same system, serving a nation rising to its destiny. An absconded slave might fetch as little as $2 if the owner was a skinflint or the nigger was busted, and as much as $100, double that, if captured out of state. Ridgway became a proper slave catcher after his first trip to New Jersey, when he went up to retrieve the property of a local planter. Betsy made it all the way from the Virginia tobacco fields to Trenton. She hid with cousins until a friend of her owner recognized her at the market. Her master offered the local boys $20 for delivery, plus all reasonable expenses. He'd never traveled so far before. The farther north he got, the more famished his notions. How big the country was. Each town more lunatic and complicated than the last. The hurly-burly of Washington, D.C. made him dizzy. He vomited when he turned a corner and saw the construction site of the Capitol, emptying his guts from either a bad oyster or the hugeness of the thing stirring rebellion in his very being. He sought out the cheapest taverns and turned the stories of the men over in his mind as he scratched at lice. Even the shortest ferry ride delivered him to a new island nation, garish and imposing. At the Trenton jail, the deputy treated him like a man of standing. This was not scourging some colored boy in the twilight or breaking up a slave festival for amusement. This was man's work. In a grove outside Richmond, Betsy made a lewd proposition in exchange for freedom, pulling up her dress with slender fingers. She was slim in the hips, with a wide mouth and gray eyes. He made no promises. It was the first time he lay with a woman. She spat at him when he fastened her chains, and once again when they reached her owner's mansion. The master and his sons laughed as he wiped his face, but the $20 went to new boots and a brocade coat like he'd seen some worthies wear in D.C. He wore the boots for many years. His belly outgrew the coat sooner than that. New York was the start of a wild time. Ridgway worked retrieval, heading north when constables sent word they'd captured a runaway from Virginia or North Carolina. New York became a frequent destination, and after exploring new aspects of his character, Ridgway picked up stakes. The fugitive trade back home was straightforward, knocking heads. Up north, the gargantuan metropolis, the liberty movement, and the ingenuity of the colored community all converged to portray the true scale of the hunt. He was a quick study. It was more like remembering than learning. Sympathizers and mercenary captains smuggled fugitives into the city ports. In turn, stevedores and dockhands and clerks furnished him with information and he scooped up the rascals on the threshold of deliverance. Free men informed on their African brothers and sisters, comparing the descriptions of runaways in the gazettes with the furtive creatures slinking around the colored churches, saloons, and meeting houses. Barry is a stout, well-made fellow, 5'6" or 7", high, small eyes, and an impudent look. Hasty is far advanced in her pregnancy and is presumed to have been conveyed away by some person, as she could not undergo the fatigue of traveling. Barry crumpled with a whimper. Hasty and her pup howled all the way to Charlotte. Soon, he owned 3 fine coats. Ridgway fell in with a circle of slave catchers, gorillas stuffed into black suits with ridiculous derbies. He had to prove he was not a bumpkin, but just once. Together they shadowed runaways for days, hiding outside places of work until opportunity announced itself, breaking into their Negro hovels at night to kidnap them. After years away from the plantation, after taking a wife and starting a family, they had convinced themselves they were free, as if owners forgot about property. Their delusions made them easy prey. He snubbed the Blackbirders, the Five Points gangs who hogtied freemen and dragged them south for auction. That was low behavior, patroller behavior. He was a slave catcher now. New York City was a factory of anti-slavery sentiment. The courts had to sign off before Ridgway was permitted to take his charges south. Abolitionist lawyers erected barricades of paperwork, every week a new stratagem. New York was a free state, they argued, and any colored person became magically free once they stepped over the border. They exploited understandable discrepancies between the bulletins and the individual in the courtroom. Was there proof that this Benjamin Jones was the Benjamin Jones in question? Most planters couldn't tell one slave from another even after taking them to bed. No wonder they lost track of their property. It became a game, prying niggers from jail before the lawyers unveiled their latest gambit. High-minded idiocy pitted against the power of coin. For a gratuity, the city recorder tipped him to freshly jailed fugitives and hurriedly signed them over for release. They'd be halfway through New Jersey before the abolitionists had even gotten out of bed. Ridgway bypassed the courthouse when needed, but not often. It was a bother to be stopped on the road in a free state when the lost property turned out to have a silver tongue. Get them off the plantation and they learn to read. It was a disease. While Ridgway waited at the docks for smugglers, the magnificent ships from Europe dropped anchor and discharged their passengers. Everything they owned in sacks, half-starving, hapless as niggers by any measure. But they'd be called to their proper places, as he had been. His whole world growing up in the South was a ripple of this first arrival. This dirty white flood with nowhere to go but out, south, west. The same laws governed garbage and people. The gutters of the city overflowed with offal and refuse, but the mess found its place in time. Ridgway watched them stagger down the gangplanks, roomy and bewildered, overcome by the city. The possibilities lay before these pilgrims like a banquet, and they'd been so hungry their whole lives. They'd never seen the likes of this. But they'd leave their mark on this new land, as surely as those famous souls at Jamestown, making it theirs through unstoppable racial logic. If niggers were supposed to have their freedom, they wouldn't be in chains. If the red man was supposed to keep hold of his land, it'd still be his. If the white man wasn't destined to take this new world, he wouldn't own it now. Here was the true Great Spirit, the divine thread connecting all human endeavor. If you can keep it, it is yours, your property, slave or continent, the American imperative. Ridgway gathered renown with his facility for ensuring that property remained property. When a runaway took off down an alley, he knew where the man was headed, the direction and aim. His trick? Don't speculate where the slave is headed next. Concentrate instead on the idea that he is running away from you. Not from a cruel master or the vast agency of bondage, but you specifically. It worked again and again. His own iron fact. In alleys and pine barrens and swamps. He finally left his father behind, and the burden of that man's philosophy. Ridgway was not working the spirit. He was not the smith rendering order, not the hammer, not the anvil. He was the heat. His father died, and the smith down the road assumed his operation. It was time to return south. Back home to Virginia and farther, wherever the work led, and he came with a gang. Too many fugitives to handle by himself. Eli Whitney had run his father into the ground, the old man coughing soot on his deathbed, and kept Ridgway on the hunt. The plantations were twice as big, twice as numerous, the fugitives more plentiful and nimble, the bounties higher. There was less meddling from the lawmakers and abolitionists down south. The planters saw to that. The Underground Railroad maintained no lines to speak of, the decoys in Negro dress, the secret codes in the back pages of newspapers. They openly bragged of their subversion, hustling a slave out the back door as the slave catchers broke down the front. It was a criminal conspiracy devoted to theft of property, and Ridgway suffered their brazenness as a personal slur. One Delaware merchant particularly galled him, August Carter. Robust in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, with cool blue eyes that made the lesser sort pay attention to his mealy arguments. That worst sort, an abolitionist with a printing press. A mass meeting of the Friends of Freedom will be held at Miller's Hall at 2 p.m. to testify against the iniquitous slave power that controls the nation. Everyone knew the Carter home was a station. Only 100 yards separated it from the river, even when raids came up empty. Runaways turned activists saluted his generosity in their Boston speeches. The abolitionist wing of the Methodists circulated his pamphlets on Sunday morning, and London periodicals published his arguments without rebuttal. A printing press, and friends among the judges, who forced Ridgway to relinquish his charges on no less than 3 occasions. Passing Ridgway outside the jail, he'd tip his hat. The slave catcher had little choice but to call upon the man after midnight. He daintily sewed their hoods from white sacks of flour, but could barely move his fingers after their visit. His fists swelled for 2 days from beating the man's face in. He permitted his men to dishonor the man's wife in ways he never let them use a nigger gal. For years after, whenever Ridgway saw a bonfire, the smell reminded him of the sweet smoke of Carter's house going up, and a figment of a smile settled on his mouth. He later heard the man move to Worcester and became a cobbler. The slave mothers said, "Mind yourself, or Mr. Ridgway will come for you." The slave master said, "Send for Ridgway." When first summoned to the Randall plantation, he was due for a challenge. Slaves eluded him from time to time. He was extraordinary, not supernatural. He failed, and Mabel's disappearance nagged at him longer than it should have, buzzing in the stronghold of his mind. On returning, now charged to find that woman's daughter, he knew why the previous assignment had vexed him so. Impossible as it seemed, the Underground Railroad had a spur in Georgia. He would find it. He would destroy it. South Carolina. $30 reward will be given to any person who will deliver to me or confine in any jail in the state so that I get her again. A likely yellow Negro girl, 18 years of age, who ran away 9 months past. She is an artfully lively girl and will no doubt attempt to pass as a free person. Has a noticeable scar on her elbow occasioned by a burn. I have been informed she is lurking in and about Edenton. Benjamin P. Wells, Murfreesboro, January 5th, 1812. The Andersons lived in a lovely clappered house at the corner of Washington and Main, a few blocks past the hubbub of stores and businesses, where the town settled into private residences for the well-to-do. Beyond the wide front porch where Mr. and Mrs. Anderson liked to sit in the evenings, the man, scooping into his silk tobacco pouch and the woman squinting at her needlework were the parlor, dining room, and kitchen. Bessie spent most of her time on that first floor, chasing after the children, preparing meals, and tidying up. At the top of the staircase were the bedrooms. Maisie and little Raymond shared theirs, and the second washroom. Raymond took a long nap in the afternoon, and Bessie liked to sit in the window seat as he settled into his dreams. She could just make out the top two floors of the Griffin Building, with its white cornices that blazed in the sunlight. This day, she packed a lunch of bread and jam for Maisie, took the boy for a walk, and cleaned the silver and glassware. After Bessie changed the bedding, she and Raymond picked up Maisie from school, and they went to the park. A fiddler played the latest melodies by the fountain as the children and their friends diverted themselves with hide-and-seek and hunt the ring. She had to steer Raymond away from a bully, careful not to upset the rascal's mother, whom she could not pick out. It was Friday, which meant that she ended the day with the shopping. The clouds had moved in anyway. Bessie put the salt beef and milk and the rest of the supper makings on the family's account. She signed with an X. Mrs. Anderson came home at 6 o'clock. The family doctor had advised her to spend more time out of the house. Her work raising funds for the new hospital assisted in this regard, in addition to her afternoon lunches with the other ladies of the neighborhood. She was in good spirits, rounding up her children for kisses and hugs and promising a treat after dinner. Maisie hopped and squealed. Mrs. Anderson thanked Bessie for her help and bid her good night. The walk to the dormitories on the other side of town was not far. There were shortcuts, but Bessie liked to take in the lively activity of Main Street in the evening, mingling with the townsfolk, white and colored. She strolled down the line of establishments, never failing to linger by the big glass windows. The dressmaker with her frilly, colorful creations draped on hooped wire, the overstuffed emporiums and their wonderland of goods, the rival general stores on either side of Main Street. She made a game of picking out the latest additions to the displays. The plenty still astounded her. Most impressive of all was the Griffin Building. At 12 stories, it was one of the tallest buildings in the nation. Certainly it towered over any structure in the South. The pride of the town. The bank dominated the first floor with its vaulted ceiling and Tennessee marble. Bessie had no business there, but was not a stranger to the floors above. The previous week she took the children to see their father on his birthday and got to hear the clopping of her footsteps in the beautiful lobby. The elevator, the only one for hundreds of miles, conveyed them to the 8th floor. Maisie and Raymond were not impressed with the machine, having visited many times. But Bessie never failed to be both delighted and frightened by its magic, bracing herself with the brass rail in case of disaster. They passed the floors of insurance agents, government offices, and export firms. Vacancies were rare. A Griffin address was a great boon to a business's reputation. Mr. Anderson's floor was a warren of lawyers' offices with rich carpets, walls of dark brown wood, and doors inlaid with frosted glass. Mr. Anderson himself worked on contracts, primarily in the cotton trade. He was quite surprised to see his family. He received the small cake from the children with good cheer, but made it clear he was anxious to get back to his papers. For a moment, Bessie wondered if she was in for a scolding, but none came. Mrs. Anderson had insisted on the trip. Mr. Anderson's secretary held open the door, and Bessie hustled the children out to the confectioner. This evening, Bessie passed the shiny brass doors of the bank and continued home. Every day, the remarkable edifice served as a monument to her profound change in circumstances. She walked down the sidewalk as a free woman. No one chased her or abused her. Some of Mrs. Anderson's circle, who recognized Bessie as her girl, sometimes even smiled. Bessie crossed the street to avoid the jumble of saloons and their disreputable clientele. She stopped herself before she searched for Sam's face among the drunkards. Around the corner came the more modest homes of the less prosperous white residents. She picked up her pace. There was a gray house on the corner whose owners were indifferent to their dogs' feral displays, and a line of cottages where the wives stared out of the windows with flinty expressions. Many of the white men in this part of town worked as foremen or laborers in the larger factories. They tended not to employ colored help, so Bessie had little information about their day-to-day. Presently, she arrived at the dormitories. The two-story red brick buildings had been completed only a short time before Bessie's arrival. In time, the saplings and hedges on the perimeter would provide shade and character. Now they spoke of fine intentions. The brick was a pure, unsullied color, without so much as a dot of mud splashed from the rain, not even a caterpillar crawling in a nook. Inside, the white paint still smelled fresh in the common spaces, dining rooms and bunk rooms. Bessie wasn't the only girl afraid to touch anything apart from the doorknobs, to even leave a speck or scratch mark. Bessie greeted the other residents as they crossed each other on the sidewalk. Most were returning from work. Others departed to watch over children so their parents could partake of the pleasant evening. Only half of the colored residents worked on Saturdays, so Friday night was busy. She reached number 18. She said hello to the girls braiding their hair in the common room and darted upstairs to change before dinner. When Bessie arrived in town, most of the 80 beds in the bunk room had been claimed. A day earlier, and she might have been sleeping in a bed beneath one of the windows. It would be some time before someone moved away and she could switch to a better position. Bessie liked the breeze afforded by the windows. If she turned her body the other way, she might see stars some nights. Bessie opened the trunk at the foot of her bed and removed the blue dress she bought her second week in South Carolina. She smoothed it over her legs. The soft cotton on her skin still thrilled her. Bessie bunched her work clothes and put them in the sack under the bed. Lately, she did her washing on Saturday afternoons following her school lessons. The chore was her way of making up for sleeping in, an indulgence she allowed herself those mornings. Supper was roast chicken with carrots and potatoes. Margaret, the cook, lived over in number 8. The Proctors felt it prudent that the people who cleaned and cooked in the dorms did so in buildings other than their own. It was a small but worthy idea. Margaret had a heavy hand with the salt, although her meat and poultry were always exquisitely tender. Bessie mopped up the fat with a crust of bread as she listened to the talk of evening plans. Most of the girls stayed in the night before the social, but some of the younger ones were going out to the colored saloon that had recently opened. Although it wasn't supposed to, the saloon accepted scrip. Another reason to avoid the place, Bessie thought. She brought her dishes to the kitchen and headed back upstairs.
Bessie?
Good evening, Miss Lucy, Bessie said. It was rare Miss Lucy stayed this late on a Friday. Most Proctors disappeared at 6 o'clock. To hear the girls from the other dormitories tell it, Miss Lucy's diligence put her colleagues to shame. To be sure, Bessie had benefited from her advice many times. She admired the way her clothes were always so crisp and fit just so. Miss Lucy wore her hair in a bun, and the thin metal of her eyeglasses lent her a severe aspect. But her quick smile told the story of the woman beneath.
"How are things?" Miss Lucy asked. "Think I'm going to spend a quiet night in the quarter, Miss Lucy," Bessie said.
"Dormitory, Bessie, not quarter."
"Yes, Miss Lucy."
"Going to, not gonna."
"I am working on it." and making splendid progress. Miss Lucy patted Bessie's arm. I want to talk to you Monday morning before you head out for work.
Anything wrong, Miss Lucy?
Nothing at all, Bessie. We'll talk then. She gave a little bow and walked to the office. Bowing to a colored girl. Bessie Carpenter was the name on the paper Sam gave her at the station. Months later, Cora still didn't know how she had survived the trip from Georgia. The darkness of the tunnel quickly turned the boxcar into a grave. The only light came from the engineer's cabin, through the slats in the front of the rickety car. At one point, it shook so much that Cora put her arms around Caesar, and they stayed like that for a good while, squeezing each other at the more urgent tremors, pressed against the hay. It felt good to grab him, to anticipate the warm pressure of his rising and falling chest. Then the locomotive decelerated. Caesar jumped up. They could scarcely believe it, although the runaways' excitement was tempered. Each time they completed one leg of their journey, the next unexpected segment commenced. The barn of shackles, the hole in the earth, this broken-down boxcar. The heading of the Underground Railroad was laid in the direction of the bazaar. Cora told Caesar that on seeing the chains, she feared Fletcher had conspired with Terrence from the very beginning and that they had been conveyed to a chamber of horrors. Their plot, escape, and arrival were the elements of an elaborate living play. The station was similar to their point of departure. Instead of a bench, there was a table and chairs. Two lanterns hung on the wall, and a small basket sat next to the stairs. The engineer set them loose from the boxcar. He was a tall man with a horseshoe of white hair around his pate and the stoop that came from years of field work. He mopped sweat and soot from his face and was about to speak when a ferocious coughing racked his person. After a few pulls from his flask, the engineer regained his composure. He cut off their thanks.
"This is my job," he said. "Feed the boiler, make sure she keeps running. Get the passengers where they gotta be."
He made for his cabin.
"You wait here until they come and fetch you."
In moments, the train had disappeared, leaving a swirling wake of steam and noise. The basket contained victuals, bread, half a chicken, water, and a bottle of beer. They were so hungry they shook out the crumbs from the basket to divvy. Cora even took a sip of the beer. At the footsteps on the stairs, they steeled themselves for the latest representative of the Underground Railroad. Sam was a white man of 25 years and exhibited none of the eccentric mannerisms of his co-workers. Sturdy in frame and jolly, he wore tan trousers with braces and a thick red shirt that had suffered roughly at the washboard. His mustache curled at the ends, bobbing with his enthusiasm. The station agent shook their hands and appraised them, unbelieving.
"You made it," Sam said. "You're really here."
He had brought more food. They sat at the wobbly table and Sam described the world above.
"You're a long way from Georgia," Sam said. "South Carolina has a much more enlightened attitude toward colored advancement than the rest of the South. You'll be safe here until we can arrange the next leg of your trip. It might take time."
"How long?" Caesar asked.
"No telling. There are so many people being moved around one station at a time. It's hard to get messages through. The railroad is God's work, but maddening to manage."
He watched them devour the food with evident pleasure.
"Who knows," he said. "Perhaps you'll decide to stay. As I said, South Carolina is like nothing you've ever seen."
Sam went upstairs and returned with clothes and a small barrel of water.
"You need to wash up," he said. "I intend that in the kindest way."
He sat on the stairs to give them privacy. Caesar bid Cora to wash up first and joined Sam. Her nakedness was no novelty, but she appreciated the gesture. Cora started with her face. She was dirty. She smelled. And when she wrung the cloth, dark water spilled out. The new clothes were not stiff Negro cloth, but a cotton so supple it made her body feel clean, as if she had actually scrubbed with soap. The dress was simple, light blue, with plain lines, like nothing she had worn before. Cotton went in one way, came out another. When Caesar finished washing up, Sam gave them their papers.
"The names are wrong," Caesar said. "You're runaways," Sam said. "This is who you are now. You need to commit the names and the story to memory."
More than runaways, murderers, maybe. Cora hadn't thought of the boy since they stepped underground. Caesar's eyes narrowed as he made the same calculation. She decided to tell Sam about the fight in the woods. The station agent made no judgments and looked genuinely aggrieved by Lovey's fate. He told them he was sorry about their friend.
"Hadn't heard about that. News like that doesn't travel here like it does some places. The boy may have recovered for all we know, but that does not change your position. All the better that you have new names."
"It says here we're the property of the United States government," Caesar pointed out.
"That's a technicality," Sam said.
White families packed up and flocked to South Carolina for opportunities, from as far as New York, according to the Gazettes. So did free men and women, in a migration the country had never witnessed before. A portion of the colored were runaways, although there was no telling how many, for obvious reasons. Most of the colored folk in the state had been bought up by the government, saved from the block in some cases, or purchased at estate sales. Agents scouted the big auctions. The majority were acquired from whites who had turned their back on farming. Country life was not for them, even if planting was how they had been raised and their family heritage. This was a new era. The government offered very generous terms and incentives to relocate to the big towns, mortgages, and tax relief.
"And the slaves?" Cora asked. She did not understand the money talk, but she knew people being sold as property when she heard it.
"They get food, jobs, and housing. Come and go as they please, marry who they wish, raise children who will never be taken away. Good jobs, too, not slave work. But you'll see soon enough."
There was a bill of sale in a file in a box somewhere, from what he understood, but that was it. Nothing that would be held over them. A confidant in the Griffin building had forged these papers for them.
"Are you ready?"
Sam asked. Caesar and Cora looked at each other. Then he extended his hand like a gentleman.
"My lady?"
She could not prevent herself from smiling, and they stepped into the daylight together. The government had purchased Bessie Carpenter and Christian Markson from a bankruptcy hearing in North Carolina. Sam helped them rehearse as they walked to town. He lived 2 miles outside, in a cottage his grandfather had built. His parents had operated the copper shop on Main Street, but Sam chose a different path after they died. He sold the business to one of the many transplants who'd come to South Carolina for a fresh start, and Sam now worked at one of the saloons, The Drift. His friend owned the place, and the atmosphere suited his personality. Sam liked the spectacle of the human animal up close, as well as his access to the workings of the town, once the drink loosened tongues. He made his own hours, which was an asset in his other enterprise. The station was buried beneath his barn, as with Lumley. At the outskirts, Sam gave them detailed directions to the placement office.
"And if you get lost, just head for that." He pointed at the skyscraping wonder, "and make a right when you hit Main Street."
He would contact them when he had more information. Caesar and Cora made their way up the dusty road into town, unbelieving. A buggy rounded the turn and the pair nearly dove into the woods. The driver was a colored boy who tipped his cap in a jaunty fashion, nonchalant, as if it were nothing. To have such bearing at his young age. When he was out of sight, they laughed at their ridiculous behavior. Cora straightened her back and held her head level. They would have to learn how to walk like free men. In the following months, Cora mastered posture. Her letters and speech required more attention. After her talk with Miss Lucy, she removed her primer from her trunk. While the other girls gossiped and said goodnight one by one, Cora practiced her letters. The next time she signed for the Andersons' groceries, she would write Bessie in careful print. She blew out the candle when her hand cramped. It was the softest bed she had ever lain in. But then, it was the only bed she had ever lain in. Miss Handler must have been raised in the bosom of saints. Even though the old man was utterly incompetent with regards to the rudiments of writing and speaking, the teacher was never less than polite and indulgent. The entire class, the schoolhouse was full on Saturday mornings, shifted at their desks, while the old man sputtered and choked on the day's lessons. The two girls in front of Cora made cross eyes at each other and giggled at his botched sounds. Cora joined the class in exasperation. It was nigh impossible to understand Howard's speech under normal circumstances. He favored a pidgin of his lost African tongue and slave talk. In the old days, her mother had told her that half-language was the voice of the plantation. They had been stolen from villages all over Africa and spoke a multitude of tongues. The words from across the ocean were beaten out of them over time. For simplicity, to erase their identities, to smother uprisings. All the words except for the ones locked away by those who still remembered who they had been before. They keep 'em hid like precious gold, Mabel said. These were not her mother's and grandmother's times. Howard's attempts at I am consumed precious lesson time, already too short after the work week. She had come here to learn. A gust sent the shutters wheezing on their hinges. Miss Handler put down her chalk. In North Carolina, she said, what we are doing is a crime. I would be fined $100 and you would receive 39 lashes. That's from the law. Your master would likely have a more severe punishment. The woman met Cora's eyes. The teacher was only a few years older than her, but she made Cora feel like an ignorant pickaninny. It's hard to start from nothing. A few weeks ago, some of you were where Howard is now. It takes time and patience. She dismissed them. Chastened, Cora snatched up her things, wishing to be the first one out the door. Howard wiped his tears with his sleeve. The schoolhouse lay south of the rows of girls' dormitories. The building was also used for meetings in need of a more serious atmosphere than that of the common rooms, Cora noticed, such as the assemblies on hygiene and feminine matters. It looked out on the green, the colored population's park. Tonight, one of the bands from the men's dormitory was playing in the gazebo for the social. They deserved Miss Handler's scolding. South Carolina maintained a different attitude toward colored progress, as Sam had told Cora on the platform. Cora had savored this fact in a multitude of ways over the months, but the provision for colored education was among the most nourishing. Connolly once put out a slave's eyes for looking at words. He lost Jacob's labor, though if the man had been talented, the overseer would have subjected him to a less drastic punishment. In return, he gained the eternal fear of any slave with a notion to learn his letters.
Don't need eyes to shuck corn, Connolly told them, or to starve yourself to death, as Jacob did presently. She put the plantation behind her. She did not live there anymore. A page slipped out of her primer, and she chased it onto the grass. The book was falling apart from her use and that of the previous owners. Cora had seen little children, ones younger than Maisie, use the same primer for their lessons. New copies with fresh spines. The ones from the colored schoolhouse were well thumbed, and she had to squeeze her letters above and in between other people's scribblings. But there was no whipping attached just for looking at it. Her mother would be proud of her, as Lovey's mother was likely proud of her daughter for running away for a day and a half. Cora replaced the page in her book. She pushed the plantation from her again. She was getting better at it. Her mind was wily, though, twisty. Thoughts she did not like wormed in from the sides, from beneath, through the cracks, from places she had battened down. Of her mother, for example. Her third week in the dormitory, she knocked on the door of Miss Lucy's office. If the government kept records of all the colored arrivals, perhaps among the many names was that of her mother. Mabel's life after her escape was an enigma. It was possible she was one of the freemen who came to South Carolina for the opportunities. Miss Lucy worked in a room down the hallway from number 18's common room. Cora did not trust her, yet there she stood. Miss Lucy admitted her. The office was cramped, with filing cabinets the proctor had to squeeze through to get to her desk, but she kept it pleasant with samplers on the walls detailing farming scenes. There was no room for a second chair. Visitors stood for their audience, which kept the visits short. Miss Lucy regarded Cora over her glasses. What's her name? Mabel Randall. Your name is Carpenter, Miss Lucy said. That's my daddy's name. My mother, she a Randall. That is, Miss Lucy said. She is. She stooped before one of the cabinets and ran her fingers over the blue-tinted papers, glancing in Cora's direction every so often. Miss Lucy had mentioned that she lived with a group of proctors in a boarding house near the square. Cora tried to picture what the woman did when she was not managing the dormitory, how she spent her Sundays. Did she have a young gentleman who took her places? How did an unattached white woman occupy herself in South Carolina? Cora was getting braver, but still stuck close to the dormitories when not attending to the Andersons. It seemed prudent, those early days out of the tunnel. Miss Lucy moved to another cabinet, tugging open a series of drawers, but came up empty. These records are only of who's here at our dormitories, she said, but we have locations all over the state. The proctor wrote down her mother's name and promised to check the master records in the Griffin building. For the second time, she reminded Cora of the lessons in reading and writing, which were optional but recommended, in keeping with their mission of colored uplift, especially for those with aptitude. Then Miss Lucy returned to her work. It had been a whim. Once Mabel ran, Cora thought of her as little as possible. After landing in South Carolina, she realized that she had banished her mother not from sadness, but from rage. She hated her. Having tasted freedom's bounty, it was incomprehensible to Cora that Mabel had abandoned her to that hell. A child! Her company would have made the escape more difficult, but Cora hadn't been a baby. If she could pick cotton, she could run. She would have died in that place, after untold brutalities, if Caesar had not come along. In the train, in the deathless tunnel, she had finally asked him why he brought her with him. Caesar said, "Because I knew you could do it." How she hated her. the nights without number she spent up in the miserable loft, tossing about, kicking the woman next to her, devising ways off the plantation, sneaking into a cartload of cotton and leaping to the road outside New Orleans, bribing an overseer with her favors, taking her hatchet and running through the swamp as her wretched mother had done. All the sleepless nights. In the light of morning, she convinced herself that her scheming had been a dream. Those were not her thoughts, not at all. Because to walk around with that in your mind and do nothing was to die. She didn't know where her mother had fled. Mabel hadn't spent her freedom saving money to buy her daughter out of bondage, that was certain. Randall would not have allowed it, but nonetheless, Miss Lucy never did find her mother's name in her files. If she had, Cora would have walked up to Mabel and knocked her flat.
Bessie, you all right with yourself?
It was Abigail, from number 6, who came by for supper occasionally. She was friendly with the girls who worked on Montgomery Street. Cora had been standing in the middle of the grass, staring. She told Abigail everything was fine and returned to the dormitory to do her chores. Cora needed to keep better guard over her thoughts. If Cora's own mask was occasionally askew, she proved adept at maintaining the disguise of Bessie Carpenter, late of North Carolina. She had prepared herself for Miss Lucy's question about her mother's surname and for other tracks the conversation might have taken. The interview at the placement office that first day had concluded after a few brief questions. The newcomers had toiled either in the house or in the field. In either case, the majority of the openings were domestic work. The families were told to exercise forbearance with inexperienced help. The doctor's examination gave her a scare, but not on account of the questions. The gleaming steel instruments in the examination room looked like tools Terrence Randall might have ordered from the blacksmith for sinister purposes. The doctor's offices were on the 10th floor of the Griffin. She survived the shock of her first elevator ride and stepped into a long corridor lined with chairs, all of which were full of colored men and women awaiting examinations. After a nurse in a stark white uniform checked her name off a list, Cora joined the group of women. The nervous talk was understandable. For most, this was their first visit with a doctor. On the Randall plantation, the doctor was only called when the slave remedies, the roots and salves, had failed and a valued hand was near death. In most cases, there was nothing for the doctor to do at that point but complain about the muddy roads and receive his payment. They called her name. The window in the examination room granted her a view of the configuration of the town and the verdant countryside for miles and miles. That men had built such a thing as this, a stepping stone to heaven. She might have stayed there all day, gazing at the landscape, but the examination cut short her reverie. Dr. Campbell was an efficient sort, a portly gentleman who buzzed around the room with his white coat flapping behind him like a cape. He probed about her general health, as his young nurse recorded it all on blue paper. From which tribe did her ancestors originate, and what did she know of their constitutions? Had she ever been sick? How was the condition of her heart, her lungs? She realized the headaches she had suffered since Terrence's blows had disappeared since she came to South Carolina. The intelligence test was brief, consisting of playing with wooden shapes and a series of illustrated quizzes. She undressed for the physical examination. Dr. Campbell looked at her hands. They had softened, but were still those of one who had worked the fields. His fingers traced the scars from her whippings. Hazarding a guess as to the number of lashes, he was off by 2. He examined her privates with his tools. The exam was painful and made her ashamed. the doctor's cold attitude doing nothing to ease her discomfort. Cora answered his questions about the assault. Dr. Campbell turned to the nurse and she wrote down his speculations over her ability to mother a child. A collection of imposing metal instruments lay on a nearby tray. He picked up one of the most terrifying, a thin spike attached to a glass cylinder.
"We're going to take some blood," he said.
"What for?"
"Blood tells us a lot," the doctor said, "about diseases, how they spread. Blood research is the frontier."
The nurse grabbed Cora's arm and Dr. Campbell stabbed the needle in. This explained the howls she had heard in the hall outside. She made her own contribution. Then she was done. In the hall, only the men remained. The chairs were full. That was her last visit to the 10th floor of the building. Once the new hospital opened, Mrs. Anderson told her one day, the offices of the government doctors were relocating. The floor was already fully leased, Mr. Anderson added. Mrs. Anderson's own doctor ran his practice on Main Street, above the optician. He sounded like a capable man. In the months that Cora had worked for the family, the mother's bad days had markedly reduced in number. The tantrums, the afternoons she spent locked in her room with the drapes shut, her severe manner with the children occurred less frequently. Spending more time outside the house,